from dizzy spells, bouts of weakness, shortness of breath, and a weak heart. Dwight looked to the paper and frowned. Yes, that's all true. Where is the contradiction?
Well, Manders said, I'm no doctor, and I don't mean to speak ill of your friend, but he clearly lists all the symptoms and signs of a heart attack, yet cites the cause as unknown.
She died of a heart attack? Not wanting to be responsible for a diagnosis, Manders shook his head no.
No, I mean, yes, well, if this is correct, I believe she could have. When was she checked?
An hour ago, possibly a bit more. Manders looked at the letter again. Dwight said, I felt her pulse myself, Robert. I even held a mirror to her nose. I tell you, it was too late when I heard the girl Farrah scream from seeing Carol fall.
Carol fell?
Collapsed. Manders' face softened.
I apologize if I seem a bit put out, Mr. Evers. It's just that I like to see these things handled as efficiently and professionally as possible. It would surprise you the number of mishandled death certificates, misdiagnosed causes, and just plain fuddled details there are in these matters. I understand you are grieving. I do not mean to put you off.
It seems to me the important part is that she's passed. I suppose for me, it matters not why.
Manders saw Dwight's eyes were wet.
I understand.
There was a short silence between them. Thunder called from far away. Dwight thought of Farrah, imagined her and Carol in the garden, imagined Carol beginning to describe the coma. Then Manders said,
But with the illness, it may be best to get a more thorough determination. It's important for all of us to know if the illness has left Harrow's or if it remains. Would you perhaps like Dr. Walker to look at her as well?
He's going to ask for a second look,
Lafayette had said.
Meaning no offense, Robert, but Alexander Wolfe's word is as good as any. No, I don't see any reason to study her again. Carol knew Alexander as well, and in my shock, I looked for someone close to us both.
Now Dwight leaned forward and whispered,
I'd like it to be a small affair, Manders, unpublicized.
You've come here to arrange the funeral, then?
Yes. You see, Manders, I'd like Carol buried as soon as possible.
Manders breathed deep. Dwight didn't like the sound of it. Was he about to let Dwight down easy in a professional manner, or did he suspect something?
I understand, Mr. Evers, but as you know, there is something of a backlog right now, a line, so to speak. 13 deaths before her own. I haven't had to work Lucas and Hank so hard in quite some time. It's really a very frightening thing, the way the illness has progressed. Rarely has Harrow's experienced such tragedy. I'm glad Carol did not fall victim to it, though I realize that matters little now. How soon were you thinking?
Tomorrow morning.
Manders, well-versed in the decorum of such moments, flashed Dwight a sympathetic face.
Mr. Evers, I'm sorry, but the soonest we can do this is two mornings from tomorrow's. As you know...
Dwight rose from the chair with a flare and stepped to a bookshelf against a wall. The lantern light barely touched the bindings, and he read what words he could. After a moment of silence, his back to the funeral director, he said,
As you can see, Robert, I'm not handling this very well.
Manders was quiet. Dwight turned to face him in the subtle flames.
If there's a way this can be done, tomorrow morning...
I'm sorry, Mr. Evers. It's just too soon.
Dwight reached his hand into his pocket, and for a moment Manders believed the man was going to bring forth money. Instead, he removed a handkerchief and wiped sweat from his brow and neck.
If only there was a way to expedite such moments, Robert. In the fog of my discontent, I'm trying very hard to do the things I think she would have wanted done. It's a shame, isn't it? The way the grieving have to make decisions under such duress. It's almost cruel the way it works out. A man spends the bulk of his adult life caring for a lady, making certain she has what she desires, serving her in any way he can, and then she is stolen. The man is robbed, and at the precise moment that his spirit is shaken and his perspective stirred, he has to make big decisions. It's no wonder. There are so many examples of these matters being mishandled. Who can blame a man for how he reacts? I certainly can't. It's astonishing anything gets done at all. There ought to be a ledger kept in which a person can jot down all that he wants done, kept out of sight so as to limit its realness while living. And when that man passes, why, we just open the book and follow the notes. Unfortunately, there's no ledger. Too unsettling, perhaps.
Manders looked to the window, as if the rain might advise him how to proceed.
"You can bring her here tomorrow morning," he said. "But the burial can be no sooner than two mornings following."
Dwight nodded. He turned again to the bookcase. Manders asked quietly,
"Where is she now?"
"Now?"
Dwight turned to face him, his features gluey in the lantern light.
"Now she is north of here."
Manders frowned.
"What is north of here?"
Dwight held the director's eyes. He flashed a sympathetic expression of his own.
"You've put me in a spot now, Manders. You see, I've decided to have someone else handle the dressing."
Manders looked surprised.
"He's not going to like that,"
Lafayette said.
"I thought you might not like that," Dwight said. "But I have family in the same trade as you."
Manders shook his head.
"I'm not worried about who does it, Mr. Evers, as long as the job gets done. Do they plan on doing it there, in the house?"
"Yes,"
Dwight said suddenly. Manders was quiet. The rain decreased, then increased against the windows.
"What are their names?"
"Excuse me?"
"Your family. I don't mean to pry, but as I've said, I like to know things will be handled well."
Dwight stepped to the chair again and sat down.
"The name is the same as mine, the Everses from Saskatoon."
Manders was quiet for some time. In his pajama shirt, he looked younger than his years, and again Dwight thought of Farah.
"As you want it, Mr. Evers. Will there be a showing?"
"No, Robert."
Dwight could hear the nails of his plan being hammered into place.
"Carol was, like most women, very protective of her image. I can't believe she'd want the town to see her this way. It's the same reason I'm asking for a quiet affair. Carol was, in her way, shy."
Manders nodded, though he'd never thought of Carol Evers as shy. As they exited the office, the pair discussed Dwight bringing Carol the morning of the funeral. Manders carried the lantern, and as the director held open the front door, Dwight placed a hand on his shoulder, then immediately wished he hadn't. It felt as though his insincerity might be transferred through touch.
"I appreciate you seeing me so late, Robert, and I apologize if things aren't entirely going through your hands. You see, Carol was a very loyal person, one of the many reasons why I loved her. Asking my family to handle things would have meant a great deal to her. As you can see, I'm struggling mightily with the loss. I do appreciate you seeing me. I am somewhat ashamed to say that the sooner this happens, the better for my constitution."
"Everything will be seen to,"
Manders said.
"All will be handled the right way."
Dwight attempted a piteous smile.
"Funny you using the word right like that, Robert. It all feels so completely wrong to me."
Then Dwight stepped into the dark and became one with the sky, the midnight, the black coach with its gray horses, and the flickering shadows beyond the wooden arch signifying the entrance to the cemetery. As Dwight rode away along the length of the graveyard, Manders could not distinguish between his shape and that of the markers, stone and wood, sticking up from the earth. It was dark. But for Dwight, a nagging flicker of distant flame came to life in his mind's eye. It was birthed immediately following a thought he'd had. Nobody knows. The light seemed to warn him, to tell him that John Bowie might be dead, and Lafayette certainly in on the deal, but Dwight might want to use that light, that distant flame, to check and make sure that nobody else knew, indeed. Moxie and the Messenger. When the message from Harrow's came in, Mr. Cadge knew exactly which of his employees should bring it to its destination. But the kid was near falling asleep on the bench outside.
"Got one for you,"
Cadge said, lowering his head to block the sun with the brim of his visor. He tapped the kid on the shoulder. The messenger looked up groggily, confused, before understanding what Mr. Cadge meant. Then he moved fast.
"Oh!"
He grabbed his hat and leapt from the bench.
"A delivery!"
"Best get on it,"
the old man said, handing the kid the folded paper.
"Thank you."
The messenger put on his hat now. He started to move from the porch, then paused.
"Mr. Cadge?"
"What is it?"
I'm nervous to meet him."
Mr. Cadge laughed the healthy drumroll of a sober man.
"I wouldn't be calling it a meeting, son. You're only a messenger, after all."
Cadge winked, and the kid still did not move. Then Cadge said,
"It's a fairly urgent telegram. Off with you now."
The messenger put the folded paper into the pocket of his vest and thanked Mr. Cadge again. The old man had come through.
"I won't tell you where the outlaw lives, boy, but I'll gladly hand you an envelope with his address upon it if and when a message comes in."
The messenger leapt from the porch. He rushed from the small gravel lot to where an old brown mare stood hitched to a post. Mr. Cadge looked out the window and saw that the kid was already on the horse, already heading north. It meant little to Cadge, James Moxey, and outlawing, and who was famous in Mackatoon, and who had made a name for himself on the trail. Whatever Moxey had done, he'd done it as a much younger man, and Cadge was just happy he didn't have to fear any gun-toting lunatic or hero ruffian sulking about his town. James Moxey had stopped by the office and introduced himself when he first moved to Mackatoon. He was just as polite and cordial as President Coopersmith appeared to be. And maybe Mr. Cadge did care a bit, after all, about who was famous and who wasn't, because he did get something of a rise, a thrill, the moment the name James Moxey escaped the newcomer's lips and traveled over the cracked desk in the office. Sure, all that outlawing was for kids. Stories to swap, big scary yarns all rolled up on one another, and easy enough to carry from one fire to the next. But they did have their merit. The trail was trashed with tales of the underlaw, the overlaw, the beyond the law, and Cadge had heard as many as the next old man. The wretched trail, bordered by black birch and impenetrable walls of half-dead hickory. Half-dead half the year, with snow at the roots, and bone-glove ice suffocating the branches. The tunnel of tales, the trail, dark enough to keep families at home at night. Mr. Cadge smiled. It wasn't easy being a pious man in these parts. And hell's heaven if James Moxey's story didn't stick out just the littlest bit. Say hey to the high hog if Moxey's feat in Aberystone wasn't just the tiniest bit more special than most. They called it the trick, and though Cadge didn't know magic from music, it was one hell's heaven of a story. Cadge went to the window again and saw that the messenger was gone, well out of view. Probably a third of the way to the one-time outlaw's house by now. Again, he recalled the day Moxey came in, standing right here before his old cracked desk, his strong hand extended over the old wood, introducing himself like any man might, saying, "Yes, thank you in advance for any messages that may be sent my way, and, look, here's where I live. Right here is where one of the greatest outlaws who ever rode the trail lives." Lives, because he did not die out there in the impenetrable black mass of shadows and madness. Unable to deny the thrill of it, Cadge laughed again, and the thought of the ebullient messenger on his way, the kid who sat slumped on the front porch for weeks at a time, waiting for the chance to meet Moxey, well, it made Cadge laugh even harder. For the messenger, the feeling was near overwhelming. He was a young man who used to travel the trail himself, before the horrors out there had him rethinking his life's path. He'd spent nights beneath the birch and maple and wondered if Moxey had done the same. He'd sometimes slept at the mossy lip of a green pond, sleeping through the celebratory sounds of the nearest town, gleeful revelry twanging through the tree walls of the trail, as if the route were a tunnel, a wire. A tube by which messages and moods were sent by hoof and heel. But just as some kids went screaming back into the house when their parents told them scary stories out by the fire, The messenger had run from the trail, unable to shoulder all the dark weight. Yet what a wonderful feeling the messenger had now. He dodged the bigger trouble of the trail, settled in Mackatoon, and was currently riding to James Moxie's house, a man he would have paid dearly to have met years ago. Oh, how he wanted to know the contents of the telegram. The horse's heavy hooves pounded the dirt, and the messenger's heart beat in sync. Yes, he was overwhelmed. His own personal imagining of the trick in Aberystown played over and over in his frazzled head. Moxie on one end of the big pit, Daniel Proud's on the other. A high, blinding sun, the call for draw, and Proud's chest exploding red before Moxie even
pulled his gun.
The messenger howled delight into the morning sky. Things were certainly hyperbolic now. The rays boring the summer clouds were alarmingly clean and bright. Dirt motes came to living life by the hooves of the horse. The trees formed a presidential, a regal path to the outlaw. The fresh morning air filled his young lungs entire, air that blew over the roof and along the walls and windows of James Moxie's house, weaving serpentine through his garden of tomatoes and onions, or so the kid had heard, splitting the wood gate at the head of his property, or so the kid had heard, and traveling the small, neat dirt walk to where he, the messenger, rode. It was an exciting moment indeed, breathing the air James Moxie breathed, living the same day as him.
"I'm going to ask him how he did it,"
the messenger said, bringing a hand to the folded telegram in his vest pocket.
"It would be a pig sin not to."
Then the messenger gasped as the trees split and a wood gate, it was true, came into view. Then a garden followed. It too was true. And finally,
"Hell's heaven,"
the messenger said.
"It's his house."
This home, he thought, a bit disappointed, was no more magical than the one he himself was reared in. And yet perhaps some magic. James Moxie was standing against a wooden beam, sure as pig shit, right there, drying his hands with a cloth, staring at the young rider approaching. The messenger's body went cold, rigid. Did he know I was coming? Could he have? The messenger gulped.
Magic, he thought.
It was a frightening ride to the gate, a tense one, and very different from how the messenger believed it would go. He'd always imagined he'd tie the horse to a hitching post and climb the mythic steps of a regal homestead adorned with gold knockers, mist, impossible unnamed creatures on the lawn. But this was no different from delivering a telegram to Mrs. Henderson, Mackatoon's prized log chopper. The outlaw was as still as the post he leaned on. He wore no smile, gave no greeting, showed no expression at all. His red buttoned-up shirt had the messenger imagining the outlaw covered in blood, carrying so many years of it with him wherever he stood. His tan hat hid his eyes.
"Hello?"
the messenger called without confidence. He raised a hand and waved. Moxie continued to dry his hands, but did not respond. At the wood gate, the messenger stopped the horse and expected a reaction, a word, but nothing came. Silent, he brought a hand to his vest pocket and removed the folded telegram. He held it up under the early morning summer sun.
"I have a telegram for one James Moxie. Is that you, sir? I mean to say, of course it's you. I came as fast as I could."
"Not on that thing you didn't." These were the first words the outlaw said to him, and at first the messenger didn't know what they meant. Then he looked down at the horse's back and smiled.
"Ha, yes, she's not in too good a shape."
Moxie stepped slowly from the beam. The messenger dismounted and looped the harness to the farthest fence post. He lifted a small latch on the wood gate and let himself in. It was a powerful feeling, stepping foot on this man's property, simple and regular as it was. The garden came to life to his right, and the brim of the old man's hat shielded his face from the sun. The messenger wanted to see those eyes. He knew well that James Moxie was close to 40 years old, more than double his own age. What did 40 years of burning fire look like, trapped in a man's eyes?
"Mr. Cadge said it was pretty urgent."
As the messenger approached, the angles of the shadows changed, and Moxie's face was revealed.
"Hell's heaven," the messenger thought. "He doesn't look all that different from any man."
A strong nose, a strong chin, dark eyebrows floating above unexceptional eyes. Moxie held out his hand. The messenger handed the folded paper to him, then said,
"How'd you do it? How'd you do the trick in Aberystown?"
Moxie took the telegram. He unfolded the paper. The messenger laughed nervously.
"I'm sorry to have asked," the messenger said. "It's just, you understand, your story is the best the trail has ever seen."
The outlaw glanced down at the message. Now, from this angle, he looked every bit the legend he was. His eyes seemed to generate heat as they read. His lips formed a perfect ruler across his face. The messenger was certainly satisfied with this. And beyond Moxie, inside the home, the messenger saw a blue owl fly in a yellow jar, resting on a small table. Moxie, finished, set the telegram on the porch fence rail and looked blankly beyond the garden, the horse, the town.
"You need I should return with the message, then?"
Moxie did not respond. A small wind came and teetered the folded paper.
"The operator said it was something urgent. You need I..."
Moxie looked the kid in the face now, and the kid saw something terrible there. The coming launch, perhaps. The legend about to perform.
"I'll need to get my things together,"
Moxie suddenly said, but not to the messenger, not to anybody at all.
"Sure, sure. You need my help?"
Absently, it seemed, Moxie turned and stepped inside. His boots clacked hard against the porch, then the floorboards within. The wind came again and rocked the folded paper. The messenger grabbed it and read, "James Moxie, sir. Carol Evers dead. Stop. Condition got the best of her. Stop. As beautiful in death as in life. Stop. Funeral in 2 days. Stop. Harrows. Stop. Understand you knew her. Stop. Mrs. Farrah Darrow." The messenger barely had time to read the last name before he saw a flash of the red shirt, and Moxie was there, before him, above him.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Moxie. I just..."
Moxie brought forth a new folded paper.
"Send this back to the same address."
The messenger looked to the paper, then back up at the outlaw, then back to the paper, before fully understanding that Moxie was answering the telegram.
"You read it," the outlaw said.
The messenger was frightened.
No, the wind...
"It said 2 days. 2 days from now. Not from yesterday?"
"No, sir. 2 days from now."
Moxie leaned forward, his face as serious as any the kid ever saw.
"Are you sure?"
"Yes. Yes, sir, I'm sure. The message came in just..."
Moxie stepped back inside. The messenger watched him come out with a green sack.
"How be, James Moxie, are you leaving then?"
Moxie didn't respond. Condition got the best of her.
"Maybe we're going the same way?"
Moxie vanished into the house again.
"I sure hope I didn't upset you. Hell's heaven, I didn't mean to do that."
But talk as the messenger might, James Moxie didn't hear these anxious words. His mind was long elsewhere, 20 years elsewhere, in a time when Carol and he were safe from memories, before they had made them. Painfully, Moxie was inside those days again, walking with Carol through a white winter. Carol's fair brown hair pressed behind her ears, her teeth that showed in her smile that exposed a brilliant mind mind that worried, in those days, about a condition the doctors were telling her was getting worse. Quickly he stepped outside. He crossed the yard, past the well, and reached the stables. Hanging inside was a full sack of feed, and Moxie brought it out. He held it above the trough and watched it spill, filling it entirely. This was for the horses he wasn't going to ride. 2 days, Moxie thought. And just then, 2 days felt like enough time. Crossing the yard again, he was at the well and filled the bucket and carried it to the stables. He moved in a pattern, routine deeds performed by a body no longer tied to the mind. He opened the gate to the pen and took his best mare by the muzzle. She was old, but she had what Moxie needed right now. Endurance. Moxie led the mare around the house, tied her to the front porch, and went in through the front door. The blue owl fly was gone. Moxie noticed this without making a big show of it, and he understood the messenger had stolen it. With its oily, shining blue wings, it was the only thing with any color in the whole house. The first thing that would have caught the eye of a fool messenger looking for a souvenir. Thief. Moxie went into the bedroom again and came forth with some bedding and a hoof pick. He carried the stuff outside, picked up the green sack, and brought it all to the mare. Slung over the east post, the saddle looked worn but ready. Pig shit thief. He rolled the bedding and tied it tight to the saddle tight to the mare. One last time he went inside. Hog-swilling pig shit thief. Moxie grabbed some bread from the kitchen and filled a pouch with some water from the pitcher. He looked once more around his small home and left it. Carol Evers dead. Stop. Condition got the best of her. Stop. As beautiful in death as in life. Stop. Funeral in 2 days. Stop. Moxie crossed his porch and mounted the mare. It was too bad the messenger wasn't going north. On that horse he was riding, Moxie could have caught up to him quick. But Moxie didn't even have quick to spare. 2 days. Riding now, past his own gardens, heading for the trail, Moxie felt the pressure of 2 days upon him, and thought, distantly, how time, like air, has a way of running out. The Wake. Eleanor, in her plain dress, stepped through the groups of 2, 3, and 4, and poured lemonade and coffee, while balancing a tray of peach cobbler and biscuit pie. She made small talk when called upon, but mostly agreed. Yes, yes, a terrible thing. Too young she was. Dwight sat on a counter stool, a stuffed pheasant upon the table, and greeted those who came to grieve. His thick hair was combed back from his forehead, revealing a troubling display in place of his normally careless visage. Never clean-shaven, he had a thick graying mustache that hung above his strong 5 o'clock beard, the tough skin stretched upon the masculine features of his face. The slight pouch of his belly was held tight by a black vest and a watch chain that was beginning to rust. His eyes were made extra cavernous by the low lighting in the parlor, the heavy black of his suit, and, as anybody would of course understand, the death of his wife. "Eleanor," he said, getting her attention as she passed, "let me know if you're in need of any supplies." Eleanor nodded. There were guests in earshot, and for this Dwight looked good.
"Of course, Mr. Evers, but don't worry about what needs us others have today. Just worry about your own."
Dwight held her free hand in both of his and nodded. Beside him was a man named Arthur, hired for the afternoon to shuffle the grievers along. Arthur, having worked in the Evers home many times, recognized many faces. The number of guests did not surprise him. Carol was a very popular woman in Harrow's. The Evers home was a big one, with 20-inch stone walls, a lime green that matched Carol's garden. The gathering was in the parlor, where a clock ticked on the mantel of a fireplace that sat dark and unused. The sun came in through the high windows. The purple drapes were tied tightly aside. Some of the attendees had been in this room before, some had not, and Dwight could tell the difference. The way the virgins fingered the drapes, studied the photographs on the walls, or tilted their heads toward the ceiling. Even under the callous umbrella of death, the home elicited wonder. Everybody stopped to examine the urn with the ashes of Carol's mother, Hattie, that stood upon the mantel beside the clock, as if she had something to do with time, and timing yet. And Carol, because of the way she'd lived her life, still cast a shadow in death. The house was, after all, hers. Paid for by her, decorated by her, spirited with 20 years of her bodily presence. No more. But Dwight counted on that shadow fading. He turned to see 2 strangers, a lady and a gentleman, standing beside him.
"We're certainly sorry to hear of your loss, Mr. Evers," the man said, holding his hat by its brim to his chest. "It's never a nice thing."
Dwight nodded.
"It's true, good man. Death is never a nice thing, even for those old enough to deserve it."
The lady took Dwight's hand and gripped it.
"If ever you need a lady to come through here, to make certain things are in order, you just call on us, Mr. Evers."
"Barbara!"
the man said, reddening. Dwight smiled. No need to blush, sir. You would be surprised how many women have offered to help. I guess it's fairly obvious, the state I'm in. Look about you. He fanned his hand to the greater part of the room. All this is her doing, from the chandelier and carpet to the very mood. Barbara frowned.
Well, Dwight said, not the mood today, but the one that usually existed in here. Carol had a manner of illumination. It's a wonder we used lanterns at all. I thank you for your offer. I may even make you honest on it.
Arthur made a congenial gesture, suggesting the widower was through speaking, and perhaps needed these exchanges of words to be brief. The couple passed. The food and drink were going fast. The people talked at length about their affairs, and death in general, and Carol's name broke through the word tangle often, as though today her name was not to be whispered. Dwight heard it many times, too many times. It wasn't unusual for her to steal a room, and he nodded slowly, guessing Carol's name had always come through other words to him, other voices, sharp and alone.
"Mr. Evers, sir."
Another gentleman stood beside him, holding his hat.
"I'd like to express my deepest sympathy for you, though I understand nothing I say can make it better. I feel it incumbent upon myself to point out that she is in a better place now."
Dwight hesitated before saying, "Well, sir, Carol and I were never what you'd call fastidious. If there be a heaven, as you allude to, I've no proof of it yet, and my findings yestereve only further confirmed this for me." He turned from the man, his eyes overcast, his lips tight to his face.
"I beg for your pardon, good sir, on such a day, but I did not mean to offend," the man said. "I can only tell you from those of us who are fastidious that she be in better hands now, hands that I have no doubt will one day touch you and show this to be true."
Dwight nodded, but his expression did not change. Despite the edginess, there was some fun in this, play-acting grief. "No need for apologies, my good man, and I didn't hope to offend thee either. Perhaps the best we can do, the compromise, is to say that the lady was too young, God or no God, and that dying is just the most awful thing we'll ever do." The stranger closed his eyes and smiled sympathetically. Then Arthur shuffled him along. Dwight saw Patricia Johns waiting next in line.
"Patricia."
She took the hand he held forth in both her own.
"I'm so sorry, Dwight."
Dwight smiled sadly.
"Would you believe," he said, "that earlier this morning a person told me no man ought to outlive his wife, that the man is supposed to go first?"
Patricia's eyes widened a bit.
"Seems a strange thing to say on such a day."
"Yes, yes, but maybe also true. Your kind are given the gift of birthing. For that, perhaps, you are sentenced to endure death as penance." Patricia clucked her tongue.
"Morbid thoughts, Dwight Evers, but understandably so."
She knelt and kissed his cheek and touched his hand, too, for a moment, before stepping into the crowd of people. Behind her stood another gentleman.
"Sir, Mr. Evers, my name is Geoffrey Hughes. We have not met as of yet, and I regret that this is the time, but allow me to say that I am a great admirer of yours in matters of business, and I'd imagine a man of your stature can perhaps lean a bit on his place in life at a time like this."
Dwight frowned. Perhaps the man didn't know Dwight conducted no business of his own. Dwight looked quickly to the urn. Hattie again. Carol's mother's money.
"Mr. Hughes, I too regret seeing your face for the first time so soon after seeing my wife's go still, but as to your comment, you must not know the method of the heart, for a lifetime of good standing appears silly to me now, and all good deeds are rendered juvenile."
"Oh, I do not doubt that, Mr. Evers, but perhaps in your darkest hour you can light the candle that shows you what you have remaining. Not many a man has had the success you have found."
At the mention of a candle, Dwight thought again of the nagging flickering he saw in his mind's eye the night before, leaving the Manders' funeral home. The unwanted thought that he may have forgotten something. Something key.
"Mr. Hughes, we are meeting here, now in my darkest hour, and I'm not aware of the candle of which you speak. The shadows you allude to have blocked me out completely from the sunny sidewalk where children play and men pass men with nods and good cheer. The sun went down yestereve, and with it the clock bell rang, a thunder rush through the house. The glass rattled a bit, the furniture rattled a bit, and I had no illusion that the darkest hour was then upon me. The details of the very bedroom she lay in dissolved and met with the shadows. The things we had shared, the simple fringe on a throw pillow, the fabric of the drapes, and bigger things, too, less visible as they are. The sound of her slippers in the hall, the soothing sound of a comb through the knots in her hair, the atmosphere she created, erupting from her like clouds from the steam pipe. All this shook and then faded quickly into the shadows created by a clock telling me it was, in fact, the darkest hour. And in that moment, Mr. Hughes, though I am aware your intentions are high, there was no candle, no, by definition of it being the darkest hour. There is no light to be seen. Arthur nodded to Mr. Hughes, gently asking him to move on. Dwight saw a young man holding a folded piece of paper standing next in line. "What's this?" Dwight asked, recognizing it as a messenger.
"A telegram for a girl who works in your house, Mr. Evers. Come all the way from Mackatoon."
That flame again. The light in Dwight's mind swayed as if touched by the wind.
"Let's have it, then."
The young man stepped forward and handed him the paper. Dwight unfolded it, and holding it close to his face, looking down the bridge of his nose, read, "Miss Farrah Darrow, do not bury, stop. Not dead, stop. On my way, stop. James Moxey." It appeared to many visitors as though, after reading, Dwight went through the gamut of all bad emotions. That's how William Muth, next in line, explained it later to his wife.
"Ah, it was terrible, Martha. All in awful slow motion. The poor man twisted, made to rise, sat again, reread the telegram, looked about the room, made something of a fist, made to rise slowly, and sat again. Whatever it was he read, I feel awful bad the news had to be put on top of the news he'd already been sentenced to endure."
Then Dwight sat still half a minute, hands folded, composed.
"I think I'll remove myself from the gathering for a moment, Arthur," he finally said.
"Of course, sir."
Dwight took the tall man's hand and rose from the stool. He patted Arthur on the shoulder and asked him quietly if he wouldn't mind asking the messenger to wait a moment before leaving. Then Dwight walked through the gathered people as his wife's name popped out of conversation in sharp, bright bursts. Ladies watched him pass, and would later comment on how he appeared to have aged 10 years since they last saw him. Others wiped tears from their eyes with their scarves. A man in his path stepped aside, and Dwight nodded absently, before recognizing him as Sheriff Opal.
"Sheriff," he said, reaching forth his hand. "How wonderful of you to be here." "Carol was one of the finest ladies in all of Harrow's, Mr. Evers."
"The finest, Sheriff."
"Yes, the finest."
Opal swallowed before saying,
"Seems a lot of death going around these days, what with the illness. If you don't mind my asking..."
"No, Sheriff Opal. A weak heart, it was." Opal held Dwight's gaze and nodded.
"Well, I don't mean to stop you, wherever you're headed."
He stepped aside. Dwight passed him and then others.
"The poor man is cracked,"
a lady whispered.
"Shaken to his bones,"
said another. He exited the parlor and stepped quietly into the hall, his boots clacking a soft rhythm on the wood. Sounded a bit like the typing of a telegram. His black suit hugged his elbows as he reached for the kitchen door, then slipped inside. More biscuit and bread and whiskey and lemonade were set out on the counter there, Eleanor's reserve, and Dwight stopped and poured himself a shot of the booze. In the same dream days, the ladies of the parlor had noted, he continued, awkward but firm, through the breadth of the kitchen to the old cellar door. He did not look over his shoulder before turning the knob and taking from the inside wall a candlestick, lit, to guide him down the shoddy wooden stairs that creaked like braying dogs for his descent. He thought of all the faces he'd seen this morning, some of them familiar, many of them not. Replaying some of the conversation, he recalled Jonas Tom's pitying attempt at future company.
He thought of the Walker girls, just 8 and 10, daughters of the doctor, their hair done up for the visit. It was a parlor chock full of condolences, a warm room turned cold with thoughts of mortality, the guests naturally contemplating their own delicate being, the fragility of their loved ones, calculating the day when they, too, would wear the face Dwight Evers wore today, or even the face Carol wore. He could hear them now, above him, the cobwebbed support blanks creaking with the shifting weight, the lamentation of voices muffled so well that not even the name of the deceased cut through like it had. Carol. No more. Carol. No more. A path was created by the candle he held, but the corners of the basement remained in shadow. It was very cold, but Dwight did not bunch up, for he planned on his visit being brief, and the temperature was welcome in that it felt no colder than his blood. Dwight stepped into the storm room Carol had long ago overseen being built, citing Harrow's fondness for windstorms and tornadoes. A stone cutaway room, with walls as thick as the ones upstairs, a cold floor, and a great table-length slab in its center, where they could put bread, food, wine, if ever they descended to avoid bad weather. Dwight set the candlestick on the edge of the slab and lifted from it a small box of matches. He stepped to the wall and struck one against the stone, the length of the room coming to life behind him. He lit a second candle, its silver-plated sconce embedded deep into the wall, then stepped farther into the room, lit another and another, until the three walls and the door were alight at last. He now faced his wife, on her back upon the stone slab, her soft features mobile in the dancing candlelight. It appeared as if her eyes opened, the corners of her mouth turned up, as if the lines of her face were fluid living lines, where life might yet flow. Then quite suddenly a second frightening thought occurred to Dwight, almost as alarming as the telegram from James Moxey. Farrah isn't at the wake. Why? He looked over his shoulder to the dark entrance of the storm room. It seemed possible then that either James Moxey or Farrah Darrow could come screaming out of that darkness, eyes like eggs, pistols in hand, firing upon the would-be widower. He thought of Sheriff Opal stepping quietly into the room.
"Weak heart, huh, Evers? And yet it still beats?"
Dwight stepped to Carol's side, his belt against the slab, his face very different now from the one he wore upstairs. He leaned over her and studied her before reaching into his suit coat's interior pocket and pulling forth a small hand mirror. He held it below her nose and counted how long it took to fog.
"Breathe," he said quietly, "but do not wake."
He lowered his face closer to her ear. He knew Carol heard voices in the coma, knew she heard him now.
"Can you fathom what little space you shall have upon waking? Can you fathom the loss of power? I am sorry for you, Carol. I truly am."
The words "buried alive" came to mind, and Dwight thought of Opal again. Farrah had written James Moxey, and what did she tell him? Dwight felt another jolt of horror peel through his blood and bones, that it was eventually squelched by the meaning inherent in Moxie's response. Not dead. As if Carol's long-ago lover, the insane outlaw of the trail, felt compelled to tell Farrah that Carol was actually not dead. This, Dwight hoped, meant Farrah suggested Carol was. How had Dwight overlooked James Moxey? When was the last time Carol had mentioned his name? Looking down at her still face, he remembered the time quite well. It was just after she'd told Dwight himself of her condition.
"Now you'll go running from me, just like James Moxey did."
Moxey was the very reason Carol had kept her condition so secret. He'd scarred her by abandoning her. At the height of young love, first love, he'd chosen the trail over her, over the care and attention he would have to pay a woman who often died. Carol told Farrah about Moxey. Why? Dwight thought of pinching his wife's nostrils shut. It would be so simple, so quick. And then there would be no worry of when she woke, no concern about what Moxey would do if and when he arrived in Harrow's. Was he really coming? Now? Dwight brought his fingers close to Carol's nose.
"No," he said. "Moxey will ask questions, ask to see if there are scratch marks inside the box. They'll dig her up, check her nose.
Not dead, he said. But not going to know, says I.
Not dead. The few words in Moxie's telegram chilled his blood to snow. He studied Carol a moment longer before stepping to the walls again and blowing the candles out in the opposite order he had lit them. Breath by breath, the room darkened. Breath by breath, fresh shadows fell upon Carol lying still. He walked the circumference of the room slowly, quietly, his shoes in rhythm with the unseen rats. He took hold of the candlestick and quietly left the storeroom. He would go upstairs again and take his seat beside Arthur, who was managing things, making fluid work of the guests. But before he got there, Dwight would stop in the kitchen and pull from a drawer a clean sheet of paper, then write the following few words. Lafayette, you are wanted. And when he left the kitchen, he would hand this paper to the waiting messenger, and he'd give the young man an extra coin or two to make certain he got the message through soon, first, next. Dwight would then ask him to return with proof of its having been delivered. On my way, Moxie had said, boldly. But Lafayette knew other people, other outlaws, other ways. Smoke limped to the broke-down carriage blocking the trail and pissed on it. He was far south, between Mackatoon and Baker, many miles from the colorful towns that offered the colorful thrills, but Smoke wasn't the sort of trigger man who sought women, whiskey, or wagers. To him, the real adventure existed on the trail itself, the miles and miles of dirt, dimmed to shadows by arching trees, some low enough that riders, even gentlemen, had to remove their hats. Smoke wore no hat. He never had. And his thinning blonde hair gripped his skull like the small fingers of the many children he'd frightened along the way. He refused to wipe the sweat that traveled down his face. Let it be hot. Let himself burn. A broken carriage was fun. A bad accident was the very variety of excitement he longed for. When he was done urinating, he fastened his pants and felt for the string loops in his pockets. These simple general store-bought cords led down the length of both pant legs and into the dust-covered boots. There they were tied to small doors at his heels, hatches Smoke could easily open with a simple tug of the loops. A popping sound, a quiet creaking of small tin hinges, and the oil that sloshed in his tin shins, his false lower legs, poured forth. A unique trigger man, even for the trail. One that even the trail watcher Edward Bunny didn't like to call on. Because the terrain was 80% shadowed at any time of day, there were plenty of places for bad men to hide. And Smoke was a bad man, a mean man. Despite rumors of things worse than men on the trail, Smoke was as monstrous as anything local folklore had invented. The blue coach was on its side. Smoke's urine traveled the length of a crack in the expensive wood. Observing the puddle at his boots, he thought the shape of it looked something like President Coopersmith. Coopersmith, like every president before her, had no good strategy for how to tame the trail. So like every president before her, she did very little, ignoring the violence and horrors therein, leaving towns like Harrow's and Mackatoon to hire lawmen and women with enough metal to do the protecting themselves. Some were successful, others were not. And Smoke, like most triggermen, knew that the spaces between these towns had no law at all. This particular carriage was blocking Smoke's passage back north after wrapping up a job in Mackatoon. Wreckage barred the entire width of the trail, and even the smallest bits of it were higher than he wanted to climb. His tin shins, though secure, were not easy to navigate. It was a lot to get over. One of the white horses had been crushed by the front end of the coach. The other whinnied and jerked, held down hard by a wheel half-wedged against a willow. This horse, wide-eyed and loud, looked to Smoke as if specifically asking for help. Perhaps it understood somehow that it was dangerously close to ending up like the broken, unmoving man beside him, face down in the dirt. A second man had been thrown farther up the trail, and though Smoke couldn't stand on his tiptoes, he had no toes, no physical legs below the knees. It was clear the man was dead. His head had caved in against another willow. The trail was littered with splintered wood, torn white curtains, jewelry and gloves, luggage and clothes. Here, a rich accident.
"Hell's heaven," Smoke said. "Tough footing for a cripple to climb."
But Smoke was no stranger to ruin. Adjusting his weight so that he was leaning on the left of his two tin shins, the oil audibly sloshing inside, he bent at the waist, squinting at the cracked window of the coach's side door. A bloodied palm appeared, sudden, flat against the glass. There was someone stuck inside.
"Oh," Smoke said, "life."
Moments before, he'd been leaning against a willow, counting cardinals in the sky. Having traveled the trail as long as he had, Smoke knew all the names, the outlaws and triggermen, the well-to-dos and ne'er-do-wells, the lawmen, the doctors, the dogs. He knew that if a man waited long enough on the side of the trail, something entertaining would be delivered to him. So when he heard the carriage wheels, he wasn't surprised. Someone was always coming on the trail. It was the only lifeline in the territory here, shared by Ukatanani and Miskaloosa counties. Sometimes, hidden deep at the base of the shadows of the willows or pines, Smoke would remove his lower legs completely, roll up his dusty pant legs, and huff the rags that had absorbed much of that oil smell. Often this woke him up. The oil high was a good high. It was a great high today. And it wasn't long after he'd wedged the rags back into place and rebelted the tin shins to his thighs that the blue carriage showed, propelled by two gorgeous white steeds. Horses that couldn't know poor footing was near. Smoke watched the legs of the steeds buckle together, their hooves caught in matching divots, as the carriage plunged forward, splintered to bits, in slow motion it seemed to Smoke, from front to middle to back. Smoke saw the looks on the driver's faces as they were thrown, heard the caterwauling terror of its passenger. Then, just as suddenly, all was still. Smoke watched the dust settle. He enjoyed the sound of rich wood cracking. Good kindling, he knew, for a good fire. Now, eyeing the bloody hand against the glass, Smoke half saying to whomever it belonged to,
"Lady, trapped in a coach of clover, I'm not going around you, so I'll have to go over."
Smoke knew better than to chance the brush that bordered the trail. False legs didn't do well with unknown footing. Once, his boots had sunk deep into jelly mud, so deep his tin shins were buried. That day, as he decided to unfasten the shins, a lawman patrolling the trail stopped to assist him. Smoke played the helpless cripple magnificently. But today, having just broiled a macatoon home to cinder, Smoke wasn't waiting for support.
"Help!"
The woman banged on the glass. The leather belts that ran up Smoke's thighs, binding him to his tin shins, had long doubled as leverage when he needed them to. Gripping one now, he lifted his right leg up and balanced one muddy boot heel on the cracked white window ledge. A faint slosh sounded as his foot connected. The boot stable, he reached high for the white trim, the cracked decorative molding wide enough for his fingers to grip. He pulled himself up.
"Help! I'm in here!"
Smoke reached level footing, the broad side of the blue coach. But the angle was not easy, and getting down was always harder than climbing. He put his hands in his pockets. He slid his fingers into the loops. He pulled on the strings. Draw. The popping sound always delighted him, the opening of the heels. The oil spread quick on the coach. Smoke watched it travel that angle, divining toward the dead driver. The scant sunlight swirled in its stream, and the oil cascaded over the body's edge, splashing the side of the coachman's nose below. Smoke inched farther up the wood and let his right leg hang over the broken back left wheel.
"Help! I'm in here!"
A red palm pounding on the glass. The oil poured symmetrical down both sides of the circle wheel, and Smoke watched it drip to the dirt beneath it.
"Is that oil?"
the woman cried.
"I smell oil!"
Smoke let go of the strings in his pockets, and the soft clicks at his heels echoed their closing. He limped carefully to the edge of the blue wood. He gauged the drop.
"Help me! I'm still inside! Can't you hear me?"
He closed his eyes, held his breath, and stepped over the edge. When he landed, dirt rose and pain exploded up his legs and back. Smoke howled. He cried out and tried to keep quiet about it, and then he cried out again.
"Who knows what shapes you'll see on the trail?"
he sang, limping, stiff-legged north, as blood from his knee stubs drooled down the tin shins he balanced upon.
"Who knows which way you'll turn?"
He stuck two fingers into the chest pocket of his cream button-up country shirt and retrieved a small box.
"Who knows how clever you are with the reins?"
Opening the box, he wiped the sweat from his forehead with his sleeve at last.
"Who knows how fast you'll burn?"
The match head came quick to life. He tossed it over his shoulder.
Whoomp! Boom!
Behind him, the carriage went up, and Smoke knew it was a good one. He limped north toward all the mad towns of the trail, all mapped out in great detail in his memory and mind, from the bootsmiths to the bawdy houses and all the bricks in the alleys between them. As if he were traveling a sheet of paper, an actual map, a series of playing cards like the ones Edward Bunny kept stitched into his brown coat to track all the outlaws and triggermen on the trail. As if the crinkling he heard was not the sound of wood catching behind him, not the sound of somebody clamoring for escape, not even the sound of her skin, heated, hot, then flaking, but rather like Smoke was leaving boot prints on the maps he'd seen in so many sheriff's offices, in every town on the trail. From the same chest pocket that held his matches, Smoke removed a folded piece of paper and read the name printed there. James Moxie. He whistled a single syllable, as though part of the song the flames sang behind him. Moxie was the biggest name Smoke had ever been hired for, and the legendary outlaw wasn't far away. Smoke limped on. Burning for hire was a way of life, but burning for no reason at all was living. Carol, in the coma. The name Moxie, spoken by Dwight, resounded so heavily that it nearly blotted out the words that followed, as if words with more emotional meaning echoed louder in Howltown. There was no doubt now that Dwight wanted her dead, and while Carol wanted desperately to tell herself that there had been no signs of this, no indication of Dwight's horrific unhappiness, she had to admit that there were. And the knowledge increased the darkness she fell through. And the horrific anxiety that came with it was blue, untamable lightning through her body. Even at 8 years old, with no understanding of what she was enduring, Carol had never been so scared in the coma, nor so alone. Among her memories and her mind's eye, bad connections were made. Dwight's behavior had been changing. He'd become mean like a dog becomes mean. The clipped manner in which he spoke, and the inordinate amount of time he'd begun sharing with the woman Lafayette. The wrinkled trail watcher was known for her shady dealings, her dismissal of all things polite and kind. Carol, in charge of all the Evers business affairs, had sworn off working with the woman long ago. And yet Dwight was drawn to her. Not sexually, of course not. Lafayette was about as appealing as a mother pig, and yet drawn to something. Carol, falling, understood that she should have paid more attention to this, should have wondered at the things and people that had begun to attract her husband's attention and time. Moxie. The name returned with a deafening clap, but did nothing to calm Carol's electrified nerves. For the deeper she fell, the farther she felt from being able to do anything about any of this at all. And the name of an old lover only added to the confusion, the warped shadows of Howltown. Dwight, Lafayette, Burial, Moxie. The way Dwight spoke, it was as if James was on his way, as if he knew she was not dead. Carol, scared as she was still intuitive enough to know that Dwight must have received a telegram. But the question that burned white among so much black was, how had James heard of her death? Carol imagined she fell past posters that described her sudden death. Posters hanging in every business in Harrow's. Carol Evers, dead. An announcement must have been made. Perhaps funeral plans as well. James got word that way, through the uncontainable spreading of bad news. And then what? In the complete darkness, falling, black wind by her ears, Carol recalled James as he was before he took to the trail, before he made the cruel decision to leave her behind, to leave love behind, too afraid to face the work of it. Pigs, Carol thought. It felt good to think it. And while she had put these bad feelings behind her many years ago, the past had a way of slithering into